Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we learned about two unique magazines. One, the granddaddy of Hollywood gossip magazines, Confidential, and the other, a publication based on men's adventure magazines from the 50s and 60s. It's called Modern Drunkard Magazine. We'll also take a look at this year's Razzies, celebrating the worst films of 2006. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Abraham Lincoln and his skill as a writer are the focus of a new book. Lincoln's Sword, The Presidency and the Power of Words was published recently by Douglas Wilson, co-director of the Lincoln Study Center at Knox College in Galesburg. Herb Trix reports.
Wilson says it all started when he was working for the Library of Congress, transcribing documents in its Lincoln collection so they could be made available on the Internet.
What I was struck by was what it told us about his craftsmanship, his interest in crafting words and revising what he had written and so forth, and changing his word choices and changing the way his sentences went, that kind of thing. And since my field was originally literature, I was especially interested in Lincoln as a writer, always have been. And that's where I started, with interest in the manuscripts and what they have to tell us. And then I started doing research on Lincoln's writing and what I could find out about Lincoln as a writer.
And Wilson emphasizes that despite what we think of Lincoln now, he was not well regarded for his writing during his life.
One of the things that people said about him was, well, it's too bad that we had to get this guy, because he might be a nice enough guy and he's friendly and he can tell a good story, but what we really need is a statesman. And this is a grave national crisis, and this guy is just out of his depth. And one editor, which I quote a couple of times, actually said, "Who will write this ignorant man's state papers?" So I got interested in that story, the story of how the public finally discovered that Lincoln was a good writer and not just a rube. His way of working was to write out notes ahead of time. And when he had enough notes, or he had the substance of it, he would get out his notes and arrange them. Herndon says that when he wrote the House Divided speech, this is before the presidency, that he carried these scraps around in his hat. And when the time came to write the speech, he emptied his hat out onto the table, and he started arranging these scraps of paper, these little notes that he'd made on the fly, and then he numbered them. And then he started to write his speech from the notes.
For example, during the summer of 1862, when the Civil War was going very badly for the Union side, Lincoln wanted to defend his conduct, but wasn't sure how.
So he was working on a text, and he had a draft, and he said to a friend, "How could I get this out? What would be the best way to get this out?" And about that time, he was attacked in the newspaper by Horace Greeley. The long, wordy harangue, scolding him and telling him what he should be doing and what he wasn't doing. And 2 days later appeared the thing he'd been working on with a little introductory paragraph, and it was, we now know it as the letter to Greeley, the very famous letter. And it had such a good effect that when he got in trouble again over public opinion, this was about the curtailment of civil liberties. In 63, he again did a public letter, and that worked very, very well.
Another good example is the Gettysburg Address. Wilson says at the time of the Union victory in the summer of 1863, Lincoln was looking for an occasion to suggest that human equality was what the war was all about. And he decided the dedication of the cemetery at Gettysburg in November 1863 would be the ideal time. And Wilson says Lincoln is perhaps one of the few historical figures who could survive the close scrutiny of himself and so many other scholars and still be considered such a brilliant writer and hero.
The only parallel I can think of is that when I first started to study Shakespeare seriously, I remember thinking, this guy cannot be as good as he's cracked up to be. But as most people who study Shakespeare discover, the more you study him, the deeper you get into him, the more amazing he is, the more the better he is. Lincoln is kind of like that. He's a guy that we think we know because he's so familiar, but when you study him, you discover that he's a very different person, and he's a more interesting person, he's a more engaging person, and he's a much deeper person than you expect.
Wilson's new book, Lincoln's Sword, The Presidency and the Power of Words, is published by Alfred A. Knopf. I'm Herb Trix.
This is Sidetrack. Go to any newsstand and you'll see all sorts of specialized magazines. Cars, food, fitness, fashion. Among all of these, one stands out. It's called Modern Drunkard Magazine. It's a bold and brash magazine that wears its mission on its sleeve, or in its highball glass, as the case may be. It's unashamed in its love of drinking. It's also a very witty and entertaining periodical. Frank Rich is the editor and publisher of the magazine, a magazine that recently celebrated its 10th anniversary. I talked to Rich recently and asked him how Modern Drunkard Magazine got started.
Well, I was driving around the country in a Corvair, 67 Corvair, and I stopped in Austin, Texas for a while, and I was really into existentialism at the time, and I was going to start sort of a satirical thing called The Modern Nihilist, or The Modern Existentialist. So I started writing for it, and I noticed I was doing most of my writing in the bars, and I finally came around to the idea that most of my experience for the last 10 years involved drinking. I've been traveling the world, just kind of absorbing different drinking cultures, and I should do a magazine about something I really enjoyed and really liked. But I was also, because I was in the center of Texas, I was noticing that alcohol is getting attacked more and more. It's becoming sort of the whipping boy for everybody's sins, and I wanted to stand up and defend it as well, because It's a great institution. I mean, it's been with us through floods and famine, through war and peace, throughout history, since we even called ourselves, you know, humans, had a written language, and not everybody was, you know, saying it was an evil thing, and that should be getting rid of and replaced by pharmaceuticals, which really bothered me.
Well, we seem very torn in our culture when it comes to drinking.
Oh, yeah.
We're told you can't drink until you're 21.
Right.
But when that second you hit 21, consume, 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 and then we get the message, moderation. You know, drink responsibly. We're kind of confused. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's totally true. It comes from America's history. I mean, we have the kind of Wild West element to our history, which involved all the heavy drinking without any regulations. Then you have the Puritan side of it, where this country was founded for a large part by Puritans, and they always had that idea where if you feel good about something, there should also be a bad feeling too. You should feel guilty about pleasure. So those things kind of fight. Is why America. We have more non-drinkers and more binge drinkers than almost any other country in the world, which is kind of weird. There's a big gulf between the two, as opposed to Europe, where they have a much more laissez-faire attitude toward alcohol, and they, you know, the kids will start drinking when they're 12 years old at the dinner table having some wine, so they never get that taboo thing. As opposed to America, these kids go to college and they're still not old enough to drink, but they'll drink in the basement of frat houses and learn how to drink there without any the peers you'd normally find in the bar room. Well, what really pissed me off, though, is that we reckon these kids, these 18 to 20 year olds, are old enough to go to war and fight and die for the country, but they're not old enough to enjoy a beer. I mean, if they're responsible enough to drive a tank, they're responsible enough to drink a beer at the local bar.
Now, getting back to the magazine proper, Each issue features a great drinker in history. And recently you featured FDR.
Right.
And Andre the Giant.
Right.
Now, did drinking make these people great, or were they just great people to start with who really liked drinking?
I think, you know, it's one of those things. I think alcohol definitely made them up. It was part of their personality. It made them what they were. It's like, you know, when you're in you're in college and you go to creative writing class or in high school, and your teacher always tells you, oh, all these great writers and artists were drunks, but just imagine how much better they would have been if they didn't touch the alcohol, which is ridiculous. If that was true, there'd be all these great teetotaler authors out there, and there's very few.
We wouldn't have a Hemingway. We wouldn't have Kerouac. You know, we wouldn't have a whole lot of authors.
All the best ones, in my opinion. I mean, they don't have many. He was a drinker. Upton Sinclair didn't drink. Emily Dickinson drank lightly. But, you know, it's just a few drops in the wide sea of talent out there. And then we say, oh, it's because they were tortured artists and they had to turn to alcohol. I don't think that's true at all. The inspirational qualities of alcohol are, to me, self-evident. You know, every day I drink. And every day when the first drinks start coming in is when I start feeling really creative and inspired. When I'm just drinking coffee, I can do more structure when I'm drinking coffee. I can lay out a magazine, but I don't really get that glow that gives me opens the door up a little bit into the inspirational soul and lets you see things you otherwise wouldn't see.
Well, talk to me. I mean, we touched on this a little bit, but talk to me more about the drunkard as cultural icon.
Well, I've always felt the great columns that kind of supported society has been the super functional alcoholic. These are the guys that, whether they're statesmen or artists or writers or whatever, those are the guys that always seem to create the most and also seem to do the most, like FDR and Churchill. And I mean, these are the guys where Churchill was, they're saying now, had a measurable amount of alcohol in the system, you know, for the entire war. And if it wasn't for those two guys, you know, the teetotaler across the channel there would have probably won. I mean, I think that's a really broad example. And it's true. I mean, almost every guy you look at throughout history who actually made a real big impact on the direction and course of history was usually a drunk. I don't think that's a coincidence.
There seems to be this line, this delineation between those drunkards of old and then, you know, the drunkard of now, and it seems that there's been a shift in the last 50 years. You want to talk about that and what the difference is now?
Well, back in the old days, they were fairly upfront about the drinking. I mean, one of the great eras was the Rat Pack era, where other cultural icons, whether it's the Rat Pack or you know, Bogart or Gleason, were very upfront about their drinking. I think they're still drinking now, but they're all being kind of hypocritical about it because they won't say so unless they're checking out of rehab. Like, then they'll blame all their faults on it. Mel Gibson, for example. Mel Gibson isn't anti-Semitic because he drank. The drinking has revealed that truth. And people they try and blame, and also Foley too. They try and blame a person's character flaws on drinking, but it's quite the opposite. All alcohol does is just a solvent that reveals them to the light. And nowadays, though, all the pharmaceutical companies are trying to replace alcohol with drugs like Zoloft. And because it's designed to attack the same symptoms that alcohol does, which is like shyness and the stress relief and so forth. But the problem with Zoloft is in these pills is there's no socialization factor with them. You don't go to get in a room with a bunch of your friends and pop Zoloft and hang out and socialize. When you drink, you go to the pub and you talk to people and you socialize and you're reminded you're part of a larger culture. The way things are going now, it's like the government and the medical community wants to replace this great socializing drug, alcohol, with these very antisocial drugs, which are just pills. It's like they just want you to pop your pills, you know, go to work, sleep, watch TV, and die like a robot. Alcohol, on the other hand, makes you more human.
Some of your recent articles in Modern Drunkard magazine include the role of booze in men's adventure magazines in the 50s, rather esoteric, but cool nonetheless. The Wingman's Handbook. Talk about those and some of the other articles that have been featured in your magazine.
Yeah, we do. It's been said we do have a kind of a male flair to the magazine, and we've never tried. You know, we have female writers occasionally, but there is a kind of masculine element to it. And we do harken back, even as far as our layouts go and our artwork, harkens back to adventure magazines of the 40s and 50s, the whole pulp effects. Because I've always had a really nostalgic feel for that stuff, and I think it's time for that kind of stuff to come back because I mean, if you look at Maxim or Stuff and all these contemporary magazines, they're more like cosmopolitan for men. But we're going back to the 50s when, you know, men were rugged and they had all these great adventures and they drank rye whiskey and they had a great time and they didn't have to hide behind any sort of psychobabble as to why they're doing it. They drink because it was fun and it was a bonding experience. Nowadays, if you drink too much, you're considered some kind of victim, like you're something wrong with you. You have a disease, which is ridiculous. I mean, alcohol's been with us all this time, and it's probably why we actually attain civilizations because alcohol. I mean, some people are saying now the first town started because people had to stay in one place and stop being nomads just so they can wait around for the beer to finish brewing.
So recently, Modern Drunkard magazine celebrated its 10th anniversary. Where does the magazine go from here?
A lot of different directions. We have a second book coming out, Adventures with Alcohol, which comes out in the summer. We're talking some TV deals right now, either a reality show or else a sort of a variety thing where we just cover alcohol in general. So we're moving to different mediums. I'm editing the Modern Drunkard movie. It's a no-budget affair, but I think it's going to make an impact because I think we're starting to hit a nerve now. People like to drink, and they're tired of feeling guilty about it. So I think we're going to continue to expand.
Modern Drunkard magazine available on newsstands and
drunkard.com.
And drunkard.com. Well, Frank Rich, thanks for joining us.
It was my pleasure entirely.
You've got attuned to Sidetrack. And now a strange little audio essay from Joel Brussel. It's about a man named Bob, a record, a witch, and a glass of scotch.
This is the story of a man who only had one album. And of that one album, he listened to only one song. The album was Hooked on Classics, and the song this man listened to at least 6 hours a day continuously was the Fifth of Beethoven. At the time, I lived in a Massachusetts boarding house about 10 minutes from where the Salem witch trials occurred. All that was left of the history of the trials was the Salem Witch Museum, which was a corny audio-visual presentation, which upon conclusion automatically emptied into the gift store. The highlight of the museum was the audio of a witch who had supposedly died from having stone upon stone piled on top of her, and her only defiant words were, "More weight, more wait. More wait," lived in the vernacular of myself and my friends for many, many years to come. But back to A Fifth of Beethoven and its perpetual keeper, a man named Bob, who was in his 50s and still lived at home with his sister, roughly the same age, and his mother, who had crippled herself many years ago from falling off the widow's walk after playing with her grandchildren. Though in his 50s, Bob still wore some variation of Ted's tennis shoes he's managed to hold on to. Despite his kiddie attire, he had one of those life-has-taken-its-toll withered apple facial core expressions always etched on his face, with a scotch in one hand with the perpetual tinkling of ice cubes. I like to think of the tinkling of his ice as an additional audio track in A Fifth of Beethoven. Bob Bob liked to position himself in the kitchen near the door, so you had no choice but to talk to him every time you entered or left the house. But the most memorable thing about Bob wasn't his limited musical choice. It was how he ended every sentence with, "Super." "How are you today, Joel?" "Super." "Going out looking for women?" "Super." "What a gorgeous day we're having." "Super." Eventually, in my mind, all I heard was the tinkle of ice cubes, an excerpt from a fifth of Beethoven. And "super." "More weight. More weight." "Super." I was convinced I was having some kind of creative nervous breakdown. "Are you okay, Joel?" "Super." "You got your whole life ahead of you." "Super."
That audio essay was produced by Joel Brussel. Still to come on the program, the worst films of 2006, and the history of Confidential Magazine. Stay tuned. You're listening to Sidetrack. February 25th marks Hollywood's annual Night to Shine. But on the night prior to the 79th Annual Academy Awards, a much smaller crowd in the same Los Angeles neighborhood will turn its attention to the opposite end of the spectrum in the world of cinema. The 27th Annual Razzie Awards will honor the past year's worst achievement in film. Jeff Bosser talked with founder John Wilson on how the Razzies got started and became a ceremony that a couple of performers have considered an honor.
Let's talk about, before we get to this year's nominations, how you got started with this, where the concept came from, and how the annual awards have grown.
The Razzies began for a couple of reasons. One of them, I used to throw an Oscar potluck dinner party in my home 27 years ago. It's hard to believe it's been that long. And Oscar night 1980, if you remember back, that was the year that Ronald Reagan had been shot and the ceremony was postponed. That was the night of the very first Razzies. That particular year, I had seen over 250 films because I was working for a company that sponsored a film festival. And two particular films had set me off. When you see 250, you begin to realize just how many of them are direct. But two particular films I happened to see as a double feature for 99 cents really set me off. It was The Village People in Can't Stop the Music and Olivia Newton-John in Xanadu, two of the worst musicals ever made. And on my way out of the theater, I actually asked for my 99 cents back. It was a sub-run theater. And when they wouldn't give me the 99 cents back, I started thinking of ways to get something back from having spent the time watching those two movies. The very first Razzies, it was in the alcove of my living room. We had a cardboard podium. We hauled people up to be presenters from the buffet table. It was very silly, very low-end, very minimalist. Within 3 or 4 years, we realized you couldn't continue doing it on Oscar night and expect to get any attention. By our fourth year, we switched to Oscar Eve, which back then was a Sunday night. And that year, we got CNN, UPI, every paper in L.A., and we started getting foreign press, and we realized we were onto something. The entire world, I guess, gets the joke, because the entire world knows what the Oscars are, and I would guess most of the world knows that the Oscars are so pompous, they are pretty much asking to be made fun of.
Where do you hold the ceremony now?
we have moved from my living room to an actual theater over the years. We had held it in hotel ballrooms. One year we did it at the old Hollywood Palace. This year we are, for the third year in a row, at a perfect little setting in Hollywood called the Ivar Theater. It's within spitball distance of the Kodak, where the Oscars will be the following night. It's a perfect size for our audience, and we actually do, many people don't know, we actually do a complete show. We have an opening number, presenters, clips, critics' quotes. We come as close as we can on a very small budget to replicating what a real award show would look like, except everything that we're talking about is garbage.
So who attends the award ceremony?
We have a voting membership of about 750 people. At the Ivar, there's a balcony that holds just under 100. That's usually full of press. It's gotten big enough over the years that we now have to do a lottery system to allot seating for it. The bulk of the audience are our voting members attending, but like I said, about 100 of them are press people.
And are these all voting actors and actresses, like members of the Academy?
Our organization is made up of three parts. One of the sectors is film professionals, people who are screenwriters, editors, directors, composers. I myself am a promo writer and publicist. Another third of the organization is film journalists, people who either are film critics, write about film, cover it. Over the years, they've heard of this thing because they've written about it or talked about it on the air, and they want to participate because they think it's so much fun. The other sector of the voting membership, which I think makes us unique, is what we call frequent film goers. These are average Joes who pay $10 to see these films and who want to participate, and that way we're getting feedback from the public as well as those of us who claim we know what we're talking about. I'm not sure if any other award has that combination of voting.
Yeah, you have the opportunity for the public to cast your vote on the website.
We do allow people to join as a film goer member. There's an annual fee of $25 for the first year, $20 a year after that. And like I said, you do get a shot at two seats for the ceremony. You get a nominating ballot. You get a final ballot. If you were close enough and wanted to attend, we do member events throughout the year. Last summer, we had a group that went to see the opening weekend of Snakes on a Plane, which was a deliberate bad movie for a change.
So tell me how this ceremony is conducted. I mean, you're all out to honor garbage, but is it everybody still dressed appropriately and
yes.
A high-class ceremony?
Yes, it does. I just got off the phone with the tuxedo shop we'll be renting the tuxes for the guys from. The female presenters wear evening gowns. They go out and get their hair done. I mean, if you were not paying attention to what we're saying, it looks like a normal awards show. That's part of the joke, is we're up there in evening gowns and tuxes, but we're saying things like, my favorite quote we've ever used in the show was about Wild Wild West. Roger Ebert said it was like spending 2 hours watching money burn on screen. That's the kind of quotes that we're looking for about our nominated pictures, actors, and actresses.
And you mentioned an opening number. I remember the years that Billy Crystal hosted the Oscars, he would have this medley. Is it something like that, or what's this opening song?
We try to do something related to the particular year. A couple of years ago, when Chicago was up for Best Picture, our opening number was All That Razz, based on one of the songs from that. Last year, we took one of the songs from Rent. I think it was 10,568 minutes.
Seasons of Love.
Yes, Seasons of Love was the title of the song. And we did a choral version of that as 365 days of really bad movies. And this year, it's going to be a song from Dreamgirls, but the Dreamgirls are going to be guys in drag.
That sounds priceless. Is there a way to, I mean, I know you get a lot of coverage, but is there a way to actually watch the whole ceremony?
Well, the problem that we've always had, and we do have someone negotiating with us right now to try and get the thing broadcast, it's incredibly well known considering it's never been aired. The problem is, once you try to do it for broadcast and it suddenly becomes a commercial enterprise, all of the rules about the clips change. Suddenly you've got copyright issues, you've got guild issues, and I've never felt that the show is the same without the clips. No matter what you say, before you show, for example, this year, I assume we will be showing a clip of Nicolas Cage in his bear suit from The Wicker Man. No matter what you say to set that up, that scene is so funny. It's integral to the show working, and it justifies. Otherwise, you kind of seem like you're just, you know, ragging on celebrities. But if you show how ridiculous their performance or the script or the direction or the costumes or whatever were, then suddenly it legitimizes the whole thing. And no one has yet been able to figure out a way, because the studios and the celebrities that we're talking about, they don't think this is funny. They really, very few of them have any sense of humor about this stuff. And they're not about to cooperate in seeing you knock their, you know, $40 million picture.
But there have been a handful of exceptions. I think probably the most notable one I read about was Halle Berry in Catwoman.
Yes, and that was wonderful because it happened to be at our 25th annual, which was a big celebratory show that we had lasted that long. And at the very last minute, I think it was the afternoon before the ceremony, we got a call. We had been trying to negotiate with her publicist, and were told that she couldn't come because she had a charity event that night. And at the last minute, the publicist called and said, okay, here's the rules. She will come. You have to sneak her in the back. Can't tell anybody she's coming. You need to tell us what you're going to say about her, because she'll be standing backstage and she'll hear it. And the quote that we used for her was, you who Halle the Academy called, they want their Oscar back. And in response to that quote, she showed up backstage with an entourage of people and her Academy Award in her hand. And when the envelope was opened and it was revealed that she was the winner, I took the stage and simply said, ladies and gentlemen, Halle Berry. And the audience, after all the years of no one showing up, they were expecting somebody in drag, I suppose. They started to laugh, but when they recognized her and realized that was a real Academy Award she was holding over her head, they went nuts. It was a great moment. And then she spent about 7 minutes doing a riff on her own Oscar speech, where she was all choked up and overcome with emotion and thrilled at this great moment in her career. And she was funny, she was self-deprecating, she owned up to how awful the movie was, and she looked amazing. I mean, she's Halle Berry. So.
One of your big slam dunk winners from a few years ago was Geely, and I believe that Ben Affleck accept his award?
What happened with him, it's interesting. We do make an attempt, once we know who the winners are, to get word to the whoever that person is through their publicist, manager, whatever contact we can get. With Ben Affleck, we tried to do that. He had said in a French magazine interview that the author called me from France and said, did you know that Ben Affleck wants to come to the Razzies? We tried to tell him, yes, we'd be delighted if you came. He didn't show up. He then, at a press conference promoting his next film within a week of the ceremony, publicly trashed us and said, why hadn't we invited him? And in response to that, I knew somebody who worked on the Larry King show, and I knew that the next night he was going to be on Larry King Live, drove an award over there, gave it to them, said, give it to him on the air, let's see what he does. It broke in his hand. He complained about how tacky it was, which is part of the joke. It is an intentionally tacky-looking, cheap little tchotchke. And then decided he didn't want to keep it. I don't know if he didn't believe it was a real Razzie or he just didn't think it was good enough for as bad a performance as he gave. But we then retrieved the award, put it up on eBay as the award that broke in Ben Affleck's hand and was seen on Larry King. It sold on eBay for enough money that it paid for the hall rental for the next year's Razzie Awards. So in our opening titles, among our sponsors we thanked was Ben Affleck.
You mentioned the award. Describe it in a little more detail.
It's a number of elements super glued together. The base of it is the plastic lid to a jar of raspberry iced tea. It's spray-painted gold and then filled with plaster to give it some weight. There's a cylinder on top of that, which is a piece of film equipment. I don't know if the general public would know what it is. It's called a film core. It's 35 millimeters high and about 3 inches around. It fits perfectly on the top of the jar lid. That's then covered with tacky wood grain shelf paper so that it looks like the base is wood. Then a Super 8 film reel is spray-painted gold, and when you do that, it kind of eats away at it and makes it look really mottled and tacky-looking. That's glued on the top of the cylinder. And then on a post, standing up top of the film reel, is a handmade beaded gold spray-painted raspberry about the size of a golf ball, and then sticking out of the top of it is a green leaf. We try to find a leaf that looks like it would be on a real raspberry, and then a plaque, if the person tells us they want it and is willing to publicly accept it, a plaque is put on the wood grain section, and the award, it vaguely resembles, of all the well-known awards, is a Grammy. It kind of looks like a Grammy award.
You look through winners of the past few years, and you see some patterns, a lot of comedies, maybe a few horror and fantasy sci-fi type things. I guess probably one of your favorite bad movies, or one that stands out, is probably Battlefield Earth, which you call one of the all-time champions.
Our nickname for that was Plan 9 from L. Ron Hubbard.
And I guess, you know, these patterns, I guess, show you here how difficult it is to make a good comedy or perhaps a good sci-fi adventure film.
Well, we do, among the several different criteria that we use in trying to decide what the likely contenders should be, we do look at what the filmmaker meant to do as against to what they'd actually achieved. If it's a comedy and you're not laughing at all, that's probably a Razzie. If it's a dramatic murder mystery and you're laughing all the way through it, like Basic Instinct or Wicker Man, that's probably a Razzie. We also look at Hollywood's own yardstick, which is money. What did it cost? What did it make? How much did it lose? Occasionally, a hit box office film has won our Worst Picture Award. I think it's only happened 3 times in the 27 years. But usually there are films like all 5 of this year's Worst Picture nominees cost a lot more to make than they grossed in the United States. And then we also look at reviews. There's a website that I love called Rotten Tomatoes that has a meter of what percentage of the reviews that they collated did and did not like it. If it's below a certain percentage, it gets a little green splat next to it that says it's a Rotten Tomato. All 5 of this year's nominated Worst Pictures were disliked by 75% or more of the critics on Rotten Tomatoes. Basic Instinct and Blood Rain were both disliked by about 95% of the critics.
I like your nickname for Basic Instinct, too. Basically, it stinks, too.
I know the story, the industry story, of why that film got made, but I don't understand. 14 years later, you don't have Paul Verhoeven to direct it. You don't have Joe Esterhaus to write it, which might be just as well because he's a horrible writer. You don't have Michael Douglas as your co-star. All you have from the original movie is Sharon Stone. It is 14 years later. Why would you make it? The story that the industry was buzzing with when the film came out, Sharon Stone signed a contract about 15 years ago. It's called pay or play in the business, meaning whether the movie's made or not, they have to pay her. It was a $14 million contract. At the time she signed it, she was hot. I think she had just gotten an Oscar nomination for Casino. They thought there was a good reason to make the movie. When a decade had gone by and it had still not been made, Sharon Stone turned around and sued the production company and insisted they pay her. They lost the case. And apparently their thinking was, rather than throw $14 million down the toilet, why don't we go ahead and make the movie? Maybe it'll be a hit. They ended up throwing away more like $70 million on this thing.
Has anybody indicated, any of these performers indicated they'd like to attend?
We haven't tried to communicate with them yet because possibly the worst experience on earth would be to show up at the Razzies as a celebrity and then not actually win. So what we do is we wait until we have some idea who's probably going to win, and then we contact them so that it also helps that they know before the story breaks if they want to do something about it, whether it's attending or defending the film or going into hiding for a week.
Jeff Bossert spoke with head Barry John Wilson, founder of the annual ceremony honoring Hollywood's worst. The Razzie Awards will be handed out February 24th in Los Angeles. you've got it tuned to Sidetrack. You can't walk through any checkout line without seeing all sorts of celebrity magazines and tabloids staring back at you. These magazines can trace their roots back to the gossip magazines of the 40s and 50s. One of the most well-known in its day was Confidential, a magazine that boasts on its cover it tells the facts and names the names. A new book has been published that covers the history of Confidential magazine and its founder, Bob Harrison. It's called Mr. Confidential, The Man, His Magazine, and the Movieland Massacre That Changed Hollywood Forever. It's published by Walford Press. I recently talked to the author of Mr. Confidential, Samuel Bernstein, about the magazine and the man behind it. I actually found an old copy of Confidential and started the interview by reading some of the headlines found in that issue. When the cat's away, mice will play, even when it's Elizabeth Taylor's hubby. And then there's another one in here. And these are all very colorful. Even though it's all black and white photos, it's a very colorful magazine.
That's right. Lots and lots of bright... I mean, it's faded over time, but when it was first published, it would have been bright red, bright yellow, bright blue. You know, very attention-grabbing.
Well, here's another one. Through the keyhole, Mae West's open door policy, and the chippy who made a chump of George Raft. Now, are these some of the typical stories you would find in Confidential magazine?
Absolutely. I mean, they're a mixture of sort of titillation, tongue-in-cheek, prose, you know, very punchy, crisp writing, and a lot of wit. I mean, I think that's something that's been lost over the years, both in terms of the way people remember Confidential magazine, but also in terms of the way gossip is reported today, where it's all very sort of cut and dried, this person did that, this person did this, without a lot of that kind of fun that Confidential magazine liked to bring to the stories.
Now, you actually talk about the Mae West article that's in this particular magazine in your book as kind of one of the big articles, the one that really stands out for you. You want to talk about that and why?
Well, it wound up standing out because it was part of there was a huge trial in 1957 when the Hollywood studios and the Attorney General of California tried to put the magazine out of business. And this is one of the stories that was alleged to be untrue, although the principal source for the story swore that it was true and there were other affidavits on file. The reason that it became so kind of luridly important was that Chalky White was murdered somewhere before he got a chance to testify. And that really had very little to do with the trial. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it was very easy to portray that as if somebody from the magazine got to him and killed him, or somebody from, you know, this part or whatever. It was very easy to make a lot out of that as if there was some deep conspiracy, when really the one thing had nothing to do with the other. And that happened a lot during the trial. There were a couple of overdoses. There were a couple of other situations that really had nothing to do with anyone from the trial, but the tabloid press, which turned on their sort of grandfather or father, they turned on Confidential with rigor and glee. And they started putting two and two together and making five so that they could sell their publication. So essentially, in the end, Bob Harrison, the publisher of Confidential, wound up sort of, you know, swallowed up by the beast that he created.
Well, yeah, let's talk about him, because you can't really talk about Confidential magazine without talking about the man behind it, and that is Bob Harrison. Tell us a little bit about him and how the magazine came to be.
Well, Bob was really kind of, I mean, if you want to think about it in like high school terms, because I'm one of those people who believes that everything is reducible to like what we all experienced in high school. He would have been the big man on campus. You know, he would have been student body president. And he was tall, he was tan, he was catnip to the ladies. He was a gregarious, funny person who didn't bear grudges, and even people who were very angry at him about what was in the magazine very often would go out on the town with him. He was best friends with Sammy Davis Jr., and yet Sammy Davis Jr. appeared in the magazine all the time. And he was somebody who really wanted to be famous, I think, and wanted to live the high life, wanted, you know, that whole cafe society thing, which was the precursor to the jet set, which, you know, is a phrase that now we don't even use. But I think that he was a deeply surfacey person. If you want to say someone can be deeply shallow, he really just wanted to be rich, popular, have the ladies on his arm, and have a good time. And he fashioned a life where that was possible. He started out with girly magazines like Titter and Wink and Flirt and Eyeful. And, you know, already the titles were kind of a harbinger of things to come with the way the headlines worked in Confidential. You know, they were so evocative. And he ended up having some trouble with the post office and with other censors and things with the magazines. And he wound up starting Confidential. Actually, he got the idea from the Kefauver hearings, which were hearings in Congress about organized crime. And now I forget her name. The girlfriend of Bugsy Malone testified, and there was all this stuff about prostitution and racketeering and gambling. And something like more television sets were sold in the first month of those hearings than had been sold in the entire year before. It was, you know, a huge part of everyone in America sort of concentrating on television as this cultural medium that everyone shared. And Bob Harrison, literally, he was going into a bar one day and couldn't get anyone's attention and realized that the television was on and that was what everyone was watching. And, you know, that was where an idea clicked in his head. And he wanted to do a magazine where you got the inside story, just like the public was getting it at the Kefauver hearings. And, you know, he had a very, very supportive, loyal family, his sisters, his cousins, his niece, his nephew. Everybody kind of banded together, and everybody pooled their money, and they went together, and it became this sort of very, in a way, conservative Jewish family enterprise that was about, you know, some very unconservative topics.
Well, Confidential magazine, it as it says on the front of the magazine, tells the facts and names the names, and it really struck a chord with readers, although people did not want to admit they read it.
No. No, I mean, Humphrey Bogart has a famous quote where he talks about how, you know, everyone reads it, but nobody admits to buying it, and they all say that the maid brought it in the house. And, you know, while everyone in America certainly didn't have a maid, everyone in America could hide behind, oh, that was my sister-in-law, or, oh, I picked it up at the beauty shop or barber shop, or, you know, nobody ever bought it. And yet 5 million people were reading it.
And it seems the people who were associated with the magazine, some of the writers and other people, were just as colorful as the Hollywood stars that the magazine covered. In particular, let's talk about Howard Rushmore.
Ooh, the villain.
Yep.
Howard Rushmore. He was kind of hopped up on goofballs in the parlance of the day, and he was this rabid anti-communist who, I mean, you know that you're kind of obnoxious when you've worked for McCarthy and Roy Cohn and all of those guys, and even they can't stand you. You know, it's, you know, your politics are right, but they were just like, oh my God, he's such a headache. He was a very, very difficult, angry, alcoholic, drug-addicted writer who was very, very vengeful. Harrison kept him around because he had been instrumental in an alliance that helped the magazine a great deal, because Howard Rushmore had been friends with Walter Winchell, who was really kind of the top, you know, media announcer gossip guy of the day. And, I mean, he had a combined audience of like 50 million listeners across the world in his day. And when Confidential launched, Harrison was a very, very canny person, and he befriended Winchell and attacked some of Winchell's enemies in the magazine. And the sort of go-between that made this introduction possible was Howard Rushmore. Now, Howard's interests were to write a lot of stories about Reds and government and all of those. From the very beginning, these were not popular stories in the magazine. Readers did not care. They wanted to read about Hollywood celebrities. And so all from the beginning, there was a kind of difficulty between Rushmore and Harrison, because Harrison really just cared about, you know, getting the readers to buy the magazine. And Rushmore had kind of this crusade on his mind. Interestingly enough, he had started out as a junior member of the Communist Party and was thrown out of the communist newspaper in America when he insisted on publishing a good review of Gone with the Wind in 1939, which was a movie that the Communist Party did not like. And so when the Communist Party, you know, took away his job, he just turned to the other side and became a very, very vociferous opponent of everything they stood for. I mean, Rushmore tried to print a story about Eleanor Roosevelt having sex with her black chauffeur. You know, he was somebody who proposed stories that were very, very undocumented, that could not be proved. In fact, one of the few times the magazine paid out out-of-court damages was on a story that Rushmore did where he swore he had the evidence, and he really didn't. And in the end, Rushmore turned against the magazine and testified against it at trial, although he was so unpleasant and obnoxious in the courtroom that many people thought he did more good for the defense than he did for the prosecution. And Rushmore, if there's a single incident that sort of turned the history or the legacy of the magazine toward the dark side, I think it was Rushmore who, right after the settlement, right after, although Bob Harrison did not lose at trial, he did sort of see the writing on the wall, and right after he had agreed to soften the magazine or perhaps sell it, Rushmore killed his wife and killed himself in the back of a cab in New York. And the headlines all over America were Confidential Publisher Kills Wife and Self. And it got mixed up with Bob Harrison and mixed up with the legacy of the magazine in ways that I think really, really contributed to the kind of L.A. Confidential James Ellroy ideas of how the magazine was just this dark, scary kind of presence.
When it wasn't. In fact, when you read through it, it is, they're all having a good time with it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you said that because it really, you look at the magazine and it celebrates Hollywood excess, you know?
And the thing that was interesting, Bob Harrison and his group of writers, he would talk about the foibles and you know, the goings-on of Hollywood people, but he wouldn't pass judgment.
No.
Well, what is the legacy of Confidential magazine? How does it affect us today?
Well, I think, you know, I'm not a person who, you know, when people say this is the first person to do this and the first person to do that, and it's, you know, everything is more complicated than that. And I am, as much as it is absolutely, I think, correct to say that Bob Harrison and Confidential, you know, started a movement, were part of the beginning of a movement that changed celebrity journalism, they were part of a larger context as well. I mean, the world was changing. America was changing. The 60s were not far ahead. And you know, Confidential, I can't say changed the world, but I can say that Confidential was part of a sort of tsunami in cultural reporting and cultural beliefs that really, really changed America. I think it opened doors in terms of what we accepted as normal in America. It's very much my belief that when you can laugh about the Lavender Lads and the Baritone Babes, then they're less frightening. And when you can laugh about miscegenation, as they called it then, it's less frightening. And when you take the fear out of that thing that is the other, you're one step closer to accepting it and realizing that it's just not that big of a deal. It's sort of like in Massachusetts, where before gay marriage came in, you know, there was a lot of the public were very opposed to it. And now that they've had it for a while, they kind of see, oh, well, the world didn't end. And Confidential, I think, was very much a part of seeing the world in a kind of less fearful way. Now, unfortunately for celebrities, I mean, Liz Smith has a great thing that she said about the book, where she says that the book makes it clear that today's celebrities and politicians all owe Robert Harrison a sock in the jaw, because definitely when he opened the closet doors and the bedroom doors of celebrities in the way that he did, it began, you know, the kind of impossible coverage today where the truly famous cannot do anything without it being broadcast all over the place. And, you know, I think Bob Harrison would have loved YouTube and TMZ and all of the things that that make gossip into a 24-hour news cycle now. But definitely the way that there are no limits. There are no barriers. You know, there is no story that at this point that someone is not willing to broadcast in some way. And I think, though Harrison wouldn't have felt that way, I think he is absolutely traceable as an author of that kind of in-depth celebrity coverage.
That was Samuel Bernstein, author of Mr. Confidential, The Man, His Magazine, and The Movieland Massacre That Changed Hollywood Forever. It's published by Walford Press. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.uiuc.edu, click AM, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL Urbana.